So a strange thing happened today on the way to the studio. We were locked out. And it is now 8:06. Is that a good excuse for being late? We couldn't get in because our normal technician is not here. And so we would have been on time. My famous last words, we would have been on time except. Anyway, life is exciting. There's always something new to keep us out of the studio or to cause us to start late. But we're here. Somehow or other, I didn't even know if we were going to make it. So let's celebrate. We're all here. Okay, welcome. Manjesh is back and in action. We didn't see you last week, Bhakti and Carol. And Kremlin, straight from the Ukraine. And we're here tonight with Manu, one of the leaders and directors of Krishna.com. So we're reading from the article, and we're going to give you the website, tstrain.com, tstrain, you want to write that in? tstrain.com, and then go to articles, and go, next, not articles, excuse me, newsletters. Newsletters, and then go to newsletter number 37, and we're going to continue reading from this wonderful article written by yours truly. Actually, not written by me, but written by Krishna, or taken from Shastra, and I was just writing it down, so I can't take any credit, but I did write it, but it's based on my experience with the life of offending devotees, and I have a lot of experience with offending devotees, so I'm totally qualified to speak on offending devotees and all the disastrous effects that result from doing such. But I think I'm learning my lesson. Now, while you're looking for that article, I want to ask you an important question. Why, if offending devotees is so detrimental, not detrimental, disastrous, for our bhakti, why would we even do it? Why would we even think of doing it, even in the wildest dreams or wildest imagination of what's possible? Why would we even consider that? Who can give me a good reason why we would offend another Vaishnava, understanding that it's so detrimental? Can anybody say? Doesn't have to be a good reason, because actually is no good reason. And that's the point of me asking this question. Ego. Very good. Yeah, ego. And how does ego translate it? I'm right, you're wrong. And I'm right, you're wrong translates into I do the right thing and you do stupid things. And therefore I'm mad at you. And therefore I criticize you. I judge you by my standards, because actually whatever I do is good. So I judge you by those standards. That's a good one. Ego. I mean, ego is very broad. Part of the ego holds us to this consciousness that I have to be right. You know, that's important for the ego, to be right. And in order to be right, I have to prove that you're not right. Another aspect of the ego, which it's very common when we are critical of devotees, particularly if we're envious or jealous, is to uplift ourselves by putting someone else down. It's there are better ways to uplift yourself than putting others down, that's for sure. But we often do that. If I push you down, then I look taller. If I keep you on the ground, then I'm higher than you. But ultimately, as we said before, if you keep someone on the ground, you're on the ground with them. You're stooping down so low, you're going down to push them on the ground. You're on the ground as well. Ignorance, yes. Ignorance can be, number one, we don't understand how detrimental it is to our bhakti. Our ignorance can also manifest as our inability to control ourselves, to control our speech. We say nasty things. We can't even control it. I can't stop myself. Or we become angry and we can't control it. Those are, ignorance is in the mode of ignorance. Excuse me, anger is in the mode of ignorance. So ignorance has many awful byproducts. And naturally, blasphemy or of devotees or being critical or envious or jealous or judging them in comparison to ourselves or comparison to an ideal standard which nobody can reach. That's part of ignorance. Another part of ignorance is that we don't tend to judge others the way we judge ourselves. We tend to be very understanding of ourselves. And it's said that we tend to judge ourselves by utility. In other words, what I'm doing according to what's practical or what's needed. But we don't judge other people that way. We tend to judge other people on another standard, a much higher standard we hold them to. Often a much higher standard than we hold ourselves to. So, ignorance, yeah. Ignorance is a big problem, naturally. What else? What's another reason? Why are we critical? I could say a really perverted reason, I think, makes us feel good. Just get it out. Just, you know, let it out at that person. You know, just let your steam off. And there's a deeper reason why it makes us feel good and why we become angry. Because whenever you expect somebody to act in a certain way towards you and they don't, you become upset. Like, if you expect someone to respect you, or you expect someone to listen to your opinion, and they totally ignore you, how does that make you feel? It makes you feel neglected, disrespected, and you want it to be heard and you want it to be respected. So you're completely let down, and what happens? You become angry. The anger is just covering up the letdown. It's not that you're actually angry, it's that you're let down. So often when we become critical of another, it's because in some way we're let down. We're betrayed. The person was supposed to do something they didn't do, or they were dishonest with us, or we really wanted to be honored and we were disrespected. We really needed to be appreciated, but we were criticized or ignored. So often if you look at what pushes your buttons and why you might criticize someone is that you expected them to behave in a certain way and they didn't, and you were really let down. And if you didn't expect them to act in a certain way, you may not be let down, but because you expect that, you're let down and you become critical. You expect, let's say someone is a superior to you and you expect them to act in a certain way and they don't live up to your standard, so you become critical. They are this, but they're acting this way. You know, one time Srila Prabhupada sat with Vishnujanaswami and he said, you know, I could criticize you, excuse me, I could criticize you and you could criticize me, but what's the point? Prabhupada was even saying, you can criticize me, you can find fault with me. If that's your objective, you can find fault with a pure devotee, if that's what you're looking for. If you're looking for faults, you'll find them, even where they don't exist. And Prabhupada said, and I can find faults with you. He said, but what's the point? What will it do for us? What benefit will it be there? Will it be for any of us? There won't be. It'll be detrimental. So if we recognize the causes of being critical, it's very helpful. I'm just being critical because I've got nothing better to do, basically. You know, it's a kind of, you know, we talk about prajalpa. Prajalpa means talking unnecessarily. We're talking about things that will not help us spiritually. Criticism is one of the greatest forms of prajalpa, of unnecessary talking. Not only is it unnecessary, some talk is just unnecessary. This is, and of course, you could say any talk that's not about Krishna consciousness is detrimental, but this is specifically very detrimental. You know, if you just talk about, you know, what Obama said, or, you know, the latest movie, you know, it's more or less just, you know, taking your time. You could be talking about something better, something more meaningful for your spiritual life. But it's not like the worst thing in the world. Of course, there may be some relevance to talking that way. But to be critical of devotees, often it's just you're letting steam out because you've been disappointed and it's not helping. What's helping is dealing with it. So can anybody think, envy, yes, envy. Yeah, if you want to get on chat, right below my picture, just click on there. And if you're watching now, but you're not on chat. So envy, what does envy mean? Well, there's two things, jealousy and envy. Jealousy means you have something I want, and envy means you have something I want and I don't want you to have it. If I'm jealous of you, I don't mind if you have it. If I'm envious of you, I don't want you to have it. So, unfortunately, Krishna, not unfortunately, Krishna says, but Krishna says, unfortunately, that we are born into envy. And when we take this body, we take birth in the material world. And so that's something we have to deal with. There are a lot of negative emotional contaminations we have to deal with when we take birth, envy being one of them. And as we said, if we're envious of someone, we want to bring them down off their position. You know, Prabhupada, he tells this story. He said once there was a group of friends, and one of them became a judge, the high court judge. And there was one friend who was really envious, and he said, that's not possible. He couldn't become a high court judge. He said, no, it actually happened. And he just, like, he couldn't acknowledge it. And I forget exactly how the story goes. He said, well, if he became a high court judge, no, yeah, this is how the story goes. If he became a high court judge, then they're not paying him because he's not qualified. So Prabhupada said, that's the mentality of an envious person. And there's another story he tells that a friend was together, and he had a bunch of his friends there, and he said, can any of you make an egg stand up on end? And they, none of them said they could do it. He said, I can do it. He took an egg, and he just knocked it and cracked it so it would stand up. And then one of the friends said, yeah, well, anybody could do that. And he said, yeah, but you didn't do it. So it's, if anybody could do it, he said, so you're trying to pull this person down. It was actually smarter than you by saying anybody could do it. Well, I gave you the chance to do it. So envy plays out often because we are not satisfied with who we are and where we're at, and we want to, you know, I mean, it's a whole problem. One of these big problems in society is everybody, yeah, you have standards, you know, what success means, and everybody's supposed to fit into that definition, but we're all different, so we all don't fit into that definition. Not everybody is super intelligent, and not everybody is super talented. You know, some people are meant to be farmers. Some people are meant to help, just help others. Some people are meant to be military men. Some people are meant to make money. Some people are terrible about money. In our society, if you can't make a lot of money, then, you know, you're considered kind of, you know, less intelligent, or you're not successful. You haven't made a lot of money. There's a joke Prabhupada tells. This man was asked, are you intelligent? And he looked in his, he was putting his hands in his pocket and pulling his pockets out. And the man said, why are you looking in your pocket? He said, well, if I'm intelligent, I'll have a lot of money. So this is how we equate success and intelligence with money. And, you know, and the whole, it's just a whole, it's a whole mess. And we don't want to acknowledge that there's hierarchy. We just want to say everybody's, you know, the same. And then if everybody's the same and you realize you're not actually as good as everybody else, but you're supposed to be the same, then you get kinds of emotional problems, psychological problems. So that can cause a lot of the criticism, a lot of the envy, is that we think we're supposed to be like somebody else that we can never be like. You see somebody and they've got certain talents that you're never going to have in a million years. You see a great musician. Some people can't keep a beat and they can't sing on key. And you could send them to the Berklee School of Music. You could send them to, what's that other one? Juilliard School of Music for the rest of their life, and they'll never be able to sing on key or keep a beat. So I guess they're not meant to be musicians. But they could have this whole negative complex, oh, I'm a terrible musician. Yeah, they might be a genius in another area of their life. You know, I think it was, who was it? When Albert Einstein was in school, you know, he was, whatever, goofing off. His teacher said, you're good for nothing. You'll never become anything. Because she had certain expectations that he couldn't meet. So I think that's a big thing in becoming envy. We're not like connected to who we are and what we're supposed to be doing, and then we become envious of people who can do things we can't do, and we're not satisfied with ourselves. And so that's a big thing. Kremlin has very little money. Oh, that's because he's not part of the Kremlin. If he was part of the Kremlin, he'd be rich. Pride. Kremlin, you have to come to America and get rich. What is it? The American dream. You know what the American dream is? I'm very close to some Indians. The American dream is that they're working 15 hours a day. Actually, last I was staying with him, he was working 18 hours a day for 3 weeks, sometimes 19 hours. That's the American dream. So you can have a nice house and a nice car, and your kids can go to nice schools, and you can pay hundreds of thousands of dollars just to see the doctor or the dentist. That's the American dream. And I just went to the dentist, and you know, he just like looked at my teeth, cleaned them, and took some x-rays, and that was $200, right? In India, that'd be $20, right? So that's part of the American dream. Anyway, work like dogs to get bread, yeah. Oh, Kremlin, you're in America now. Wow, in Beaumont. Wow, amazing. See, you're coming for the American dream. And I hope you don't end up, when you graduate, working 15 hours a day. I pray to Krishna you don't, because it's not good. Okay, so what are we, where do we look at? Look at your own faults. Yeah, yeah. Carol says, because you don't want to look at your own faults. Did you ever happen to notice how other people's faults are so easy to see and your own faults are so difficult to see? Any of you noticed that? In fact, when was the last time you were looking at your faults? When was the last time you were looking at someone else's faults? You could probably remember the time you were looking at someone else's faults more easily than when you can remember looking at your own faults. So that's a big problem. We discussed that right in the very first show. And Srila Bhaktisiddhanta said that's actually the reason. We're looking at others' faults. Others' faults, I don't know, they're so nice to look at. We get so much satisfaction at looking at others' faults. Look at so-and-so. Look what he's doing. He's such a this, she's such a that. Well, it gives us such deep, deep pleasure, doesn't it? But to look at our own faults is extremely difficult and painful. It's much more juicy to see another person's fault. We don't get pleasure from seeing our own faults, unfortunately. We should, but we don't. It should be really our life substance. That's very good. Kremlin is going to return to the Ukraine as a teacher. That's nice. Brahman. We feel vindicated that there are others in the world who have similar flaws. Yeah. We don't like to... Yeah. Well, yeah. If I find a defect in you, then it's okay that I have it. Is that what you're saying? Yeah. So that I don't have to work on my own, because I see everybody. Well, everybody does this. So what's wrong? Why can't I do it? You know, nobody's doing this. They all say you're supposed to do it. Nobody can do that. As the Prabhupada said, don't be a nobody. Don't be ordinary like everybody else. Yeah. If you look at everybody else, you know what they say. Wherever the crowd's going, make sure you don't go there, because they're always going the wrong way. So if you just want to go with everybody, then you'll probably end up in the wrong place, unless those everybodies are pure devotees. Well, nobody can do this, and everybody's doing that, so it's okay. Well, we say, well, at least I'm not as bad as them. Oh. We have a standard. If you study Prabhupada's books, he gives us this standard. It's such a high standard. The pure devotee, you'll see so many places in Prabhupada's books. The pure devotee, and then he explains what the pure devotee does, or how the pure devotee thinks, how the pure devotee prays, how the pure devotee relates to others. Then you look at that standard and you think, this is such a high standard. So is Prabhupada putting it there so we can all read it and go, oh no, I can't do this. This is impossible. Prabhupada put it there just to convince me, or just to let me know that I can't do this. No, obviously not. He put it there to let us know that's where we're supposed to be going. Now, if we're not there, that's okay. As long as we're on the road, as long as we're making progress, it's okay not to be there. You don't have to beat yourself up and kill yourself. But we should be on the road. We should be moving at least a mile an hour towards it. So then it's okay. Then we're okay. So, you know, Prabhupada didn't really want us to think, at least I'm not as bad as them. He, you know, he had high aspirations for us. And the higher the aspiration, the higher you'll go. And if you think, well, I'm okay, I'm not as bad as them, probably not going to go very far. Then your goal in life is just not to be as bad as them. Well, it's just not that hard because people are pretty bad in general, or they can be anyway. The average person, you know, is not that spiritual. So to not be as bad as them is not saying that much. But you want to be, you want to follow in the footsteps of devotees, great devotees. Okay, I want to thank you for all your answers. Pride. Oh, I didn't deal with pride. Pride. What does the Bible say about pride? Who knows? I'm not even a Christian, and I know. So you should know. What does it say? Anybody know? Pride precedes. Yeah, pride comes before a fall. Yeah. So, Bhaktivinoda Thakur said, pride just undermines everything good. And Raghunath Das Goswami said, he compared pride to the urine of a monkey. I don't know if any of you have ever had the opportunity to smell the urine of a monkey or touch it. Raghunath Das Goswami says, pride is like bathing in the urine of a monkey or a donkey, one or the other. I don't know. I don't know which one is worse. But, you know, in other words, the analogy is it's that pride is it's something that we relish, but really, for a spiritualist, it's so detrimental. It's just poison. It's just stinky, smelly, and we don't realize it, unfortunately. I think that's part of a big problem in our spiritual life. When there are things that are really bad for us, we don't recognize it, and then we relish, hey, Prabhu, you're bathing in donkey urine. Yeah, yeah, it's nice. I like it. That's pride, you know, to want to be acknowledged, to want to be known as a great devotee, to want to be acknowledged as one famous for something. That is so much not the mood of a pure devotee that it can undermine everything. And then naturally, if that's the mood, it's very helpful to be critical of others because that reinforces our position. And then you might ask, well, wait a minute, you know, I was born into this body with this mentality, and it's not like I cultivated pride or envy or any of the things we're talking about. They're just like there. So Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says something that's really nice. He says that as you advance in devotional service, as you become purified, you will see, as you know, you become aware that you have all these non-devotional tendencies. But he says that as you advance in devotional service, those tendencies will just be like aromas, like you can kind of smell it, but it's not doing anything. It's not going to divert you. And the other thing he says is that if you indulge in those tendencies, then what it does is it creates the desire to continue indulging. So the solution is, okay, I recognize I'm proud, I recognize I'm envious, I recognize, you know, I have the need to be right, and I like to bring people down, and I get pleasure from finding others' faults and so on. So he's saying, but don't indulge in it. So that if the tendency's there, that's one thing, but indulging it reinforces it. And every time you indulge in it, it creates a desire to do it again. And if you've ever, and I'm sure you've all experienced that, when I grew up, there was a commercial for some kind of cracker. And I don't know, with these crackers, the way they do it, they put salt and sugar in crackers. If you look at the ingredients, they put salt and sugar. If it's not, it's a salty. In the salty ones, they put more salt, but there's sugar. And the sugary ones, they put a little bit of salt, like in peanut butter and sugar. And so these crackers have these spices and the salt and sugar. So it just, when you eat it, it activates your taste buds and digestion. And like Prabhupada said, good food makes you want to eat, even if you're not hungry. I don't know if you have that experience, but someone says, you're at someone's house, and they go, here, I want to offer you this. And you go, no, I'm not hungry. No, just take a little. And you take a little, and it's so good, you end up eating a whole meal, and you weren't even hungry. So Prabhupada said, that's good prasadam. So they had this commercial that said, I bet you can't eat one. And the whole idea was, because they're so good, the way they're spiced, and they're so addictive, that you can't eat one because you'll always grab another. You always eat like three or four or five. Do they have that commercial now? No, you have to be over 50 to have seen that commercial. So it's the same way, you know, when we indulge in all the contaminations that we bring with this body and mind, when we indulge them, then the propensity to continue doing them becomes stronger. So Vishwanath Thakur, Bharti Thakur is saying, don't indulge in them, indulge in bhakti, and then what will happen is all there'll be is this fragrance of them. In other words, you'll be aware of them, it'll be like a fragrance in the distance. I can smell the lust, I can smell the greed, I can smell the pride and envy, but it's just a fragrance, you won't have to act on them. And then always understand that whenever these desires are there, you always have a choice whether to act on them or not. Oftentimes when they're there, we think, well, now I'm doomed, I have to act upon them. I don't know if you've ever thought that way, but it's quite common. You know, sometimes you just feel this pushing of envy or jealousy or pride or whatever, and then you feel like, well, I have to act on it because it's there, but you don't. And that's part of the process of bhakti, to overcome that. So we understand what's proper behavior, what's improper, and then if we feel like acting improperly, we just choose not to. We're strong enough. And because we know, if we indulge in it, it's just going to overtake us. So, Lay's, is it Lay's potato chips? Wow. Kremlin. No, they still have that ad, huh? Bet you can't eat one. Huh. Maybe we could say for the Maha Mantra, bet you can't chant one. Okay, these are all very good suggestions. Very good feedback. Thank you. It's an all commercial, I guess. Yeah. Kremlin, what do you watch? TV shows with old commercials or what? How did you see that? It's very old because it's from the it had to be from the 50s. 70s, yeah, before that, no. Okay. Anyway. So, let's read a little more. Unless someone has a question or want to say something. There's a really good reason why we find fault. Who could think of it? One more. Okay, let's go for one more reason, a juicy one. It's a really good reason we find fault that we haven't mentioned. Can anybody think of something? Got a good one? Mana's going to type. He's got a good one. We expect perfection in an imperfect world. Isn't that true? And I would add to that, we expect others to be perfect. And we don't expect ourselves. Oh, I mean, you may expect yourself to be perfect. Yeah, you might. Some do, some don't. Yeah. This world is so full of dirt. We just want to see perfection somewhere. You know, we just hanker after it. And then those who we expect to be perfect and we see they become angry or upset or something and we're so let down. Oh, he was supposed to be perfect. He was supposed to be this or that. She was supposed to be this. You know, that happens a lot in marriages, you know. Before you get married, you think your spouse is perfect. It's only till you start living with them that you soon realize they have many imperfections and sometimes that comes as a big shock. So if any of you are going to get married, I will let you know in advance that your spouse is not perfect. And no matter how much you believe that, it's not true. So yeah, and now Bhakti and Carol comes up with another very important reason. We can't face our own guilt, we have to blame others, yes. So often we're blaming others for the problems we have. We feel guilty about having these problems, but we avoid acknowledging the problems in ourselves and thus having to experience the guilt by just blaming others, seeing that fault in others. And then we're like innocent. We're like, we escape that whole world of guilt and emotional pain for being the way we are just by seeing it in others. Divert our attention to others. So, yeah, Pallavi, we're not at peace with ourselves. Yeah, you know, you could imagine someone who is very satisfied, like very self-satisfied in their life, in their service, in their ashram, in their bhakti. They're just happy, or just by their nature, they're happy people. You know, some people like that, they're just happy. You say, you know, you ask the people like that, what do you need to be happy? And they say, I need to be breathing, or I need to be above ground, or, you know, like, they just have to be alive, and they're happy. And other people are not like that. So, you know, have you ever noticed when you're, like, really dissatisfied with yourself, is that when you're, like, always complaining about everything? Have you noticed that? So who's ever around you, you'll complain about them, because you're just unhappy. They have this cartoon, and I'm Jewish, so it's known that Jewish people, they complain a lot. So there's this typical cartoon, and this Jewish guy is on the subway in New York, and he's like, "Oy vey, am I thirsty? Oy vey, am I thirsty?" He's just going on like that. "Oy vey, am I thirsty? Am I thirsty?" You know, that's their nature, to complain. So the people are all around them, are like, he's driving them crazy, so he gives them some water. He drinks, you know, like a quart of water, and he goes, "Oy vey, was I thirsty? Oy vey, was I thirsty?" So that's just the nature of that kind of person, you know. They're going to complain about something, you know. So, not at peace. So bliss is saying, what about the guru? Does he have to be perfect to help us? No. Prabhupada was once asked, do you know everything? And he said, no. And what he said was, sometimes we see, you know, you don't remember something or forget something. And Prabhupada said, no, that's not what the guru is. See how the guru is spreading the teachings of Krishna, you know, giving his life to spreading the teachings of Krishna. So Prabhupada said, you don't know what perfection is. It's not that the guru is materially perfect, but he's given his life to spreading Krishna consciousness. That's his perfection. So sometimes, yeah, one could even find fault with a guru, expecting perfection beyond what he has to have to be guru. And there are different levels of gurus. Some gurus may not be more materially perfected than others. And that's a whole other topic. But, you know, when we're talking about forgiveness, when we're talking about criticism, when it enters that area of the guru, it's serious. So, you know, and sometimes you can address your guru with these questions. That's important. Does he have to be Uttama Adhikari to help us attain perfection? This is a perennial question. And the answer is definitely yes and no. You know, there's two definitions Prabhupada gives for Uttama Adhikari. One definition is that he's situated in the highest levels of bhakti. He doesn't even have the propensity to criticize others. You know, he lists all these qualities of the highest uttama. And then he lists another quality of another kind of pure devotee. He said, one who's following the principles of Krishna consciousness, 16 rounds, 4 regs, and given his life to spread Krishna consciousness, he's an uttama adhikari. So he gives that definition also. So Prabhupada said, find a genuine spiritual master. The shloka is there. Find a genuine spiritual master who can inspire you. And, you know, the thing is where I think devotees get a little bit sidetracked. It's like when, you know, the Shastra says, find a genuine spiritual master. You know, think of it within the context of society where you're like out on your own in the world, and now you have to search out. You got to find, you know, you're born in India. You read this verse and says you have to find a bona fide spiritual master. And now you hear these stories of people who leave their homes, leave their villages, and go out in search of a guru. Indians, you know, there are several Indians who met Prabhupada that way. They were searching for a guru, right? So they go out, and you know, they met many gurus, but it just wasn't the right one, and just didn't resonate with them, and they finally met Prabhupada. So that is not really a problem now, because we're all in ISKCON. So it's like you don't have to go down the list. Okay, here there's 70, I think there's 72 gurus initiating in ISKCON. So generally you don't have to worry about which one's bona fide or not. I wonder which one is bona fide. It's more of a question of which one inspires you, which one you can take shelter of. So Prabhupada's saying, find a bona fide spiritual master. And now, by Krishna's mercy, he's created so many persons who you can take shelter of, even though they're not even giving diksha. There's so many people you get guidance from. Just like, I don't give diksha. I've not given diksha to anyone, and now you're listening to me. So that's Prabhupada's mercy. You know, that I can somehow, I'm still here, that's Prabhupada's mercy, and I can say something about Krishna. And I can say something that I've heard from Prabhupada and repeat that. So then you know what I'm saying. You know, you don't, is this Mahatma bona fide or not? I don't know. You know, maybe he doesn't know what he's talking about. But yeah, that's true. I don't know what I'm talking about. Therefore, I just speak what Prabhupada says. So does Uttama Guru ever fall down? Well, Shastra says you can fall down from the stage of Baba. But the thing is, at least within the ISKCON, everybody is taking shelter of Srila Prabhupada. So maybe one guru is a little more advanced than another guru, but everyone has access to Prabhupada. So it's not like if your guru is not quite as advanced as another guru, that you're really handicapped. No. Because you can hear from all gurus. And every guru is also advancing. So you can have many siksha gurus. So I think if you look at it more in practical terms, you know, you may take diksha from one guru, but you, there are so many people you can hear from, and you have access to Prabhupada's books, and your guru is also advancing. And you can take guidance in so many places. So it's not like it might have been in other times when you just find one guru and he, and you take shelter of him, and that's all there is, and it's him or nothing, and you really have to be careful. Not exactly like that. I mean, I'm not speaking philosophically here so much, but I'm speaking practically. You know, if you look at it practically, you know, you may look at 20 gurus and think, you know, these one or two are very advanced and these others aren't. But you know, it's also subjective and how. You know, is your father the best father in the universe? Objectively, probably not. But for you, he's the best father. You don't want another father. He's your father. So it said, you know, guru, tattva, it's inconceivable because, you know, one who takes shelter of a guru may find this guru to be everything, and he puts his full faith and he's totally inspired by that guru, and someone may not be inspired by that guru. Does it mean that guru is not bona fide? Not at all. So it's an individual thing. Does an Uttama guru ever fall down? We can fall down up to the platform of prema. Generally, if that Uttama guru is eternally liberated, no, he won't fall. If that Uttama guru is coming from the platform of sadhana siddhi, then when he's not completely perfect, he may fall. There's still some contamination in the stage of Bhav. It's not common that one would fall, but it's possible. That's the beginning sunlight of love of God. Do we need to go and find our guru? I heard when it's your time, guru will find you. Yes and no. It said when your desire to become Krishna conscious is strong, then I would say at that point, the stronger your desire is, the more you'll know who your guru is. Maybe he'll find you, maybe you'll find him. But Shastra says you should find a guru. It doesn't say you should sit and wait for one. But the sense of he'll find you is the sense is when you're sincere, Krishna will make some arrangement for you. But until that point, when you're sincere enough that you really want to advance in Krishna consciousness, it may not, you may find your guru and you may not realize that he's your guru. You know, that happens a lot according to your thirst or your hunger for spiritual life. You may meet your guru, but the need is not great at that point, so you don't realize he's your guru. Or she, someday in ISKCON we'll say she is your guru. Can I fully take shelter of Prabhupada even now I'm not initiated? Yes. You must take shelter of Prabhupada. Especially you must if you're not initiated. And you can take shelter of anyone else you want. You know, both, they're not mutually exclusive. Getting guidance from someone else and getting guidance from Prabhupada, and someone else can help you better understand Prabhupada. That's practical. Can I fully take, you can take shelter of Prabhupada as your Siksha Guru. There's no problem with that. As your Diksha Guru, that's not the tradition. But as your Siksha Guru. Prabhupada is a Siksha Guru for so many people. Okay. Now we have 13 minutes. What should we do? Should we read? Or does someone have another question about offending devotees or proper behavior? You know what it means to be a guru? Prabhupada said, I see all my disciples as my guru. So, and Prabhupada said, one who's the follower becomes guru. What about non-devotees criticizing devotees? Oh yeah, Shastra says you should kill them. Cut out their tongue. Convince them or run away. Now, the killing and the cutting out of the tongue is specifically recommended for Kshatriyas. But within our social situation, that probably would not be a good idea. So either you could try to convince them that what they're speaking is not proper or not beneficial, or you could just leave. It's important not to hang around, because we read that story, or we told the story about Ramchandra Puri, and everyone in his village became implicated in his blasphemy of Nityananda and Takahari Das. So you don't want to be connected with persons who are critical of devotees. So best thing is ask the person to stop speaking that way and tell them, you know, if you continue speaking that way, I'm going to leave because I don't want to hear this. And you can actually feel it contaminating your heart if you lend yourself. Adi Kavi said, my guru said if the guru falls down, he was never a bona fide guru in the first place. Well, there's a there is some teachings about gurus falling down in the past. So Prabhupada said that, you know, I would say that, you know, if he falls down, perhaps he was not on a very high level. But, you know, if you define guru as one who's following the four regs, one who's initiated, following the four regular principles, chanting 16 rounds, and understands the philosophy of Krishna consciousness as a fundamental definition, then that certainly from that platform, many people will fall down. From a very high platform, it'll be less likely. But, you know, it depends how you define guru. There are different levels of guru. There are different kinds of gurus. Some gurus are simply, you know, can help people who are not Krishna conscious in understanding the fundamental principles of Krishna consciousness. And some gurus can help people go very deeply into Krishna consciousness. And they themselves are very advanced. But the main thing we always saw with Prabhupada is he wanted us to be strictly following. He said, if you strictly follow your guru, then you can become guru. If you're initiated by a bona fide spiritual master, you get the mantra from him, it works, whether he's a great devotee or not such a great devotee, because you've received it in the cyclic line. Prabhupada once wrote a devotee who was not initiated and said, you've heard the mantra from my disciples who heard it from me. Now you can give that mantra to other people, and that mantra is bona fide. So she wasn't even initiated. So you see there's different levels. You know, someone could say, well, the power of that mantra will not be very strong. But really, the power comes in receiving it through a bona fide chain, and you taking the mantra. And it's not like some magical thing where you don't have to do anything, and you've got this powerful seed, and you can go to sleep. You know, it requires your own work as well. The whole topic of guru, that's a whole different world. But what I would say, because we're talking about offending devotees now, and I made that point, is that when you expect a person to live on a certain level, I don't want to say of perfection, but in the case of guru, you might think that way, and you expect it. You should be on a certain level of perfection or a certain level of behavior, and they fall short of that, that's when the tendency to criticize is there. Now, he is supposed to be like this, but I see he's like that. He's supposed to be intimate disciple of Prabhupada, but I see he's acting this way, or he said this. So then we can get ourselves into trouble. Sometimes it's said, in order to evaluate who is a pure devotee, one has to be a pure devotee. So it's a very dangerous area to traverse, I think. And I also think that, you know, Maya wants us to, you know, to create conflict amongst ourselves, and that's a great area for conflict and understanding who's guru, who isn't. My guru is better than yours. You know, that whole world. It's not really a good world to enter. I think a better world to enter is I'm more fallen than you. You're better than me. And I'm just a fool. And I only exist by the mercy of all the Vaishnavas, and please give me your mercy. That's the actual proper attitude. And if we don't have that, that attitude will tend to be offensive. So bliss is saying, what if we offend someone and then we feel bad, and how do we approach them? Well, Bhaktivinoda Thakur advises that, and Shastra says that, there'll be a reaction for offending a devotee until we beg forgiveness. And devotees generally are very kind, and they will forgive us. The difficult part is if you've offended someone and they're not aware that you offended them, and then you ask for forgiveness, and it might put them in an awkward situation. Say, please forgive me for offending you. Then they'll start thinking, what's wrong with this devotee that he's offending me? You know? It's a complicated issue. But in general, Bhaktivinoda Thakur says we should ask for forgiveness. And we talked about that in other shows. And that's, we can approach them directly or send them an email and beg them to forgive us. And then if they don't forgive us, just ask Krishna. Or continue to beg for forgiveness from them. And ask Krishna also. Now, another question is, what if we offend someone? You say, what if we offend someone and feel bad, and how do we ask for forgiveness? What if we offend someone and we don't feel bad? And we don't want to ask for forgiveness? That's another problem. We may offend someone and think, well, they deserve it. I'm just calling a spade a spade. That may be sometimes, but, you know, what's your motive? You know, is it vicious criticism? Is it helpful? Is it beneficial? Bhakti Karo says, lack of humility, we criticize, yeah. Amanira amanadena. This is, offer all respects to others, want none for myself. Lack of tolerance. You know, one of the things, same verse, Trinadapi Sunichena. Todorivasi should not be more tolerant than a tree. It's very interesting to note that we can know so many things and act contrary to all the things we know. And we can go on for years acting contrarily. And my realization is this, and I think this is a good way to end. We have 4 minutes. There's a really important point, and this is something that that I've realized over the years is that we don't change unless there's a desire to change. And that desire comes through the advancement of Krishna consciousness. Just like, you know, what is the most fundamental reason we criticize? I mean, or the most fundamental reason we do anything? It's because we want to. There's no, you know, if you want to reduce it, reduce anything that you're doing, even things that are hurting yourself, even detrimental things, perverted things, if you really want to reduce it down to its fundamental cause, we do things because we want to do them. It doesn't, you know, you may think, no, that's not why I criticize. Well, if you don't want to do it, why do you do it? Why do you criticize? So my point is that as you advance in devotional service, you begin to develop a desire to want to appreciate devotees, glorify them, and you want to, and you develop a desire to be more humble, to not draw attention to yourself, to not have a need to put others down to elevate your position. And until we come to that, we're not going to develop a strong, develop real humility. I'm not even talking about that, just the desire to practice it, to restrict ourselves so we can practice it, so we can control our speech. We won't even be successful doing that unless we develop a desire for it. So that's where spiritual advancement comes in. Because until there's a desire to be humble, no one's going to act humbly. It's not part of our nature. Our nature is to be proud, jealous, envious. So understanding that's our nature, we overcome it through our spiritual advancement, which develops within us another desire, a desire to not be proud and envious. And so when you evolve to a certain point where you're really feeling it, I want to be humble, that's when things change. And before that, they don't change. You understand it intellectually, but you'll continue going on habitually. You'll habitually want to draw attention to yourself. You'll habitually want recognition. You'll habitually put people down. You'll habitually be critical. Because you still haven't developed a strong enough desire to overcome that. Maybe you don't understand you need to do that. Maybe the contamination is so strong that it's going to take years and years before you develop that desire. Maybe you don't have the association of others who have that desire, and therefore it's not being, you're not getting motivated. It's not touching your heart. But that's how we change. We come to a point, you know, like you say, you know, like they say, are you sick and tired of being sick and tired? And then you do something. You know, you change your diet, you start exercising. And it's not till you come to that point, you just say, I'm sick of being sick. And then you change. I'm not going to eat sugar anymore. I'm not going to eat white flour. I'm not going to eat fried foods. I'm going to exercise every day for half an hour. I'm only going to eat whole grains. I'm not going to do this. So, you see, that's when it happens. So, you know, it's a hard thing to face, but it's true. We criticize because we want to. You don't do things you don't want to. You don't wake up in the morning and make a list of things you don't want to do and then do them. That's not how it works. Okay. Lack of humility, lack of tolerance. Not able to see what devotees they are. Yeah, not able to see the good qualities in them. We just finished our online course in forgiveness, and everybody did a little presentation at the end. And one devotee wrote a poem about her brother. She was just glorifying her brother, seeing all the good in him. And when she came in, she was only seeing the bad. And so she realized, you know, there was so much good that she wasn't seeing. So everything changed. She changed her attitude. So she started to see the good, you know, see, that's powerful. Please forgive me for any wrong question, Prabhu. I came late and have asked wrong question. No, it wasn't wrong. It was just whatever. It was fine. Not seeing with the right vision who we are, who everything else is, what our position is. Yes. You know, the more we're situated in Krishna consciousness, the easier it will be to control our mind and senses, at least to be situated in Satvagun. When we're situated in the mode of passion and ignorance, that's when we're having all these problems. You know, you ever notice, you try to chant your rounds and you're in the mode of passion, you can't do it. You have to be in goodness. So it's the same thing. We're trying to control our propensity to fault find, to criticize, and when we're in the mode of passion and ignorance, it's extremely difficult to control. So, you know, the more you understand Krishna consciousness and how the process Prabhupada gave it, the more you see we're meant to be situated in goodness, and then from goodness all these things become much easier to do. I had a friend, he was saying, it's not even a question of when you chant your rounds, the time of day, it's a question of the mode you're in. Of course, generally in the morning we're in the mode of goodness, but it's really a question of a mode. So it's a, I think it's the same thing with this. It's a question of what mode we're in. You know, in the mode of passion and ignorance, what do you do in the mode of passion and ignorance? Well, just read Bhagavad Gita, Krishna tells you. Right? Envious, put people down. You know, you see all the demoniac qualities. Harshness. Yeah, and these are all our conditioned tendencies. Very easy for them to come out. But we're in the mode of goodness, it's less likely. So, through the process of bhakti, we elevate ourselves to goodness. And then, you know, we can even be with someone we dislike or perhaps we would be, tend to find fault with. And I was saying in another show, and then we'll realize, well, this devotee has so many good qualities. Why don't I focus on his good qualities? Because that will inspire me. I don't get inspired by seeing his faults, but I do get inspired by seeing his good qualities. But so somehow or by Maya's trick, I'm seeing his faults and just becoming discouraged and upset. But by Krishna's mercy, I'll see his good qualities. And I'll get inspired. Bliss says, how important it is to read every day to help us advance, or as much as possible. I get busy and have a hard time reading. Read early in the morning then. Just read something. Because it clarifies your intelligence. It's very important. It's important to write also. It's so easy. It's so easy to get out of Krishna consciousness. And it's so much more difficult to get out of Krishna consciousness when we're reading and feeding our intelligence. Because when the intelligence is strong, then we can see the material world more from the view of the pure devotee, more as Krishna explains it. But when we're not hearing from the pure devotees, then we tend to see the material world through the eyes, through our material eyes. And what do our material eyes see? I'm the center, I'm the enjoyer. Right? The moderator says, I listen to the Bhagavad Gita audiobook in the mornings while getting ready for work. Yeah, put a tape on. I mean, a CD or on your MP3 player, you can download so many lectures. He's saying if you have a hard time reading, they even say that hearing is more powerful than reading for understanding and retaining. So, yeah, that's wonderful. Something. You know, we all want to hear something. Hear about Krishna, it's very powerful. It's one of the main processes. You know, everywhere in the Shastra it says you'll become purified through hearing. Your heart will become purified. You'll receive the mercy of the devotee through hearing from them. How can I get Bhagavad Gita audio book? Let me take a guess. You go to krishna.com/. There it is, store.krishna.com, store.krishna.com. Well, you can buy it there or download it, or both.
You can listen to it online.
You can listen to it online.
Krishna.com/Gita, I think.
You can't download it. Krishna.com/Gita. I was just listening today. To Diksha Karunika, that one?
To Diksha Karunika, but the one that I listen to is Dravida because he has the purports as well.
Oh, yeah. Or on Dravida, yeah. He has the purports. Or you can record it yourself and listen to it. Oh, yes, if you didn't know.
A story from his life about his own diksha and shiksha guru and humility.
Okay, we're going to read a story. Manu has found us a story. We'll end tonight because today is the appearance day of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, and here's a story about the humility. About humility. Once, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur and his son, come assistant, Srila Shridanta Saraswati, Bimal Prasad, went to see Bhaktivinoda's guru, Vipin Bihari Goswami. Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur's dealings with his Diksha Guru were always exemplary. Even though Vipin Bihari Goswami was not very advanced, being a Kanishna Adhikari, Neophyte Guru, whereas the Thakur was an Uttama Adhikari, Paramhansa, of the highest order. Still, So Bhaktivedanta needed to find a Vaishnava to take initiation from, and I believe at that time that was the only person he could get it from. So to get the mantras and so forth, and he really didn't see him as his siksha guru, as the one but he still respected him as his guru. Still, Bhaktivinoda Thakur always played the humble disciple. On one such occasion, in the presence of young Siddhanta Saraswati, Bhaktivinoda Thakur paid his respectful obeisances to his guru. Bipin Bihari Goswami replied by placing his feet on the Thakur's head. For the young, fiery Siddhanta Saraswati, this was too much. It was one thing that his father had accepted him as his formal initiating spiritual master, but this was going too far. Srila Siddhanta Saraswati was only 7 years old at the time, but when Bhaktivinoda Thakur left the room, leaving the two of them alone, Siddhanta Saraswati decided to set things straight. And I guess this is what he said to Bipin Bihari Goswami: "You are acting like a big, big guru, and you place your feet on the heads of those who you don't know. If you knew who the Thakur is, you would not do it, but you do not know. My father is a great, exalted Nitya Siddha, eternal associate of Sri Radha and Krishna, who has come here to fulfill their mission. Do you think that you are so advanced that you can place your feet on the head of such a person? I think not. You have proven yourself to be a Kanishta Adhikari, neophyte, by not being able to distinguish between those who are advanced and those who are less advanced. Therefore, I suggest that you desist from this practice any further." Bhaktivinoda Thakur then re-entered the room and the conversation changed. Later that day, Bipin Bihari Goswami mentioned to Bhaktivinoda Thakur, "Your son is bold to point out, is bold to the point of being rude." Later, Thakur Bhaktivinoda found out about the conversation and used to jokingly glorify his exalted son to his friends, saying how he is fearless that he even chastised my guru, Bipin Bihari Goswami. Reflecting on this incident, we can see that even if one's spiritual master is not an Uttama Adhikari, Mahabhagavat devotee of the Lord, still one should be satisfied and serve him always. Bhaktivinoda Thakur, who himself was certainly a Mahabhagavat, set the example how to serve and show respects. On the other side of the transcendental coin, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati showed a nice lesson to us. We should not show ourselves to be more advanced than we really are, lest we commit offenses against those who are actually advanced. Very nice. So,
this is from the Seventh
Goswami. This is from the book called The Seventh Goswami, available at Krishna.com. So, the Bhagavad Gita audio by Dravida has the purports. And there's one by a devotee named Titikshiva Karunika, which is just the verses, which is also available on YouTube.
Let's ask the last question.
Last question. Siksha means instruction. And so, guru means teacher. And diksha means initiation. So, a disciple only has one diksha guru. The diksha guru is the guru who gives the mantras. You receive Harinam in ISKCON in Gaudiya Math. At first initiation, you receive the mantra. Of course, you've already been chanting the mantra, but now, your guru accepts you as his disciple. You agree to follow the four regulative principles and chant 16 rounds. So that's in ISKCON what is called first initiation or Harinam Diksha. And second initiation is when you receive Gayatri Mantra and the other mantras of our Sampradaya. And that traditionally was considered the real initiation. And so you have one Diksha guru who gives you those mantras. Then Prabhupada said generally, who's ever instructing you, who's your siksha guru, will become your diksha guru. But and then Prabhupada said, you can have many diksha gurus, but only one siksha guru. So you'll get the mantras and make your vows and from a diksha guru, and then you'll take instruction from your diksha guru, and you'll take instruction from others. And particularly, you know, the idea of siksha guru is that you've also taken shelter of this person. And of course, in our movement, Srila Prabhupada is the supreme Siksha Guru, and we all represent Srila Prabhupada. So every Siksha Guru is representing Srila Prabhupada, as is the Diksha Guru. So we're all one big happy family. And you might say, well, Why would one accept another guru other than his own Diksha guru? Because there are many gurus, and one guru may inspire you in a particular way or be more expert. Let's say you're into deity worship, and one guru is expert in deity worship, and your guru perhaps is expert in something else other than deity worship. So you may take guidance from this Siksha guru. Or it may be that you're living in a certain part of the world and your guru lives somewhere else, or he travels and you don't get much of his association, and your guru has other disciples or god brothers who act as his representatives, or there are other devotees who you have a lot of faith in and you take guidance from them. And they don't have to be giving diksha. So this is a traditional system. That's a brief understanding. You can have only have one diksha guru, but you can have many siksha gurus. Not that you necessarily would want to, or you know, your diksha guru may have left his body. You want to take guidance from someone else. That is very common. So, and you're like bliss right now. You may already have some people that you that inspire you or you have faith in, and you know, in one sense, they could be your siksha gurus, unknown to you. So, you know, in a traditional society, guru, there are many, many people act as guru. Guru means teacher. You have a music guru. You can have so many gurus, an art guru. And you can have a spiritual master, spiritual guru, who guides you in spiritual practices. And in either case, in Vedic culture, guru is always given the highest respect, whether he's diksha or siksha. So, bliss says, I'm his guru. Hare Krishna, thank you. And you have so many other gurus. In the Bhagavatam it says there are 24 gurus. The dog's your guru, because from the dog you learn how to get up as soon as you wake up. And so many things in nature are gurus we learn. And as we advance in Krishna consciousness, we'll see gurus everywhere. Even our wife is our guru, our husband is our guru. And our wife says, you stupid idiot, why did you do that? And so she's acting as our guru to keep us humble. So you see, my wife is my guru. She keeps me very humble. Right? So we have so many gurus. Is it criticizing to tell others what? Carol, Bhakti and Carol. Is it criticizing to tell others? I don't know what you mean by that. But
to tell others that you were criticizing somebody?
Oh, to tell others that you were criticizing somebody. I think it's good to tell others. I think it'll help you overcome that problem. Just don't tell them what you said. That would not be good. Say, I was criticizing so-and-so, and I feel very bad, and like that. Just, you know, don't pollute the others by telling them what you said. Okay. Bhakta Bliss. So now I have a new disciple, Bhakta Bliss. And Bhakta Bliss, you can have so many gurus, so many wonderful devotees who can help you in Krishna consciousness. And you, all of you out there, you can take shelter of so many devotees and get help. We want to get help wherever we can get it. Okay. All right, I think we've told you where you can get the Bhagavad Gita audio. Hare Krishna. So, we'll initiate Bhakta Bliss someday. If he doesn't get initiated by anybody else, then we'll initiate him in... when you come, Bhakta Bliss, when you come to the point where you don't criticize any more devotees, then you can get initiated. You know, there's a story, this one devotee was in Vrindavan and he met one of his friends, and it was during Kartik, and it's typical during Kartik, you take a vow to not do something, like, I'll only eat once a day, I won't eat any sugar, you know, something that you like to do, and you just take a vow not to do it. So this devotee said, he met his friend, he said, what are you doing for Kartik? And he said, I've taken a vow not to criticize anybody. And the devotee thought, what kind of vow is that? That's not a vow. You know, it's not a big thing. Then the devotee thought about it, and he thought, well, actually, that is a good vow. I'll take that also. And then as soon as he took the vow, he realized how difficult it was not to be critical, because our mind tends to just be on automatically be critical. So, mahat@aol.com. That's the one I look at the most. Or mahatmadasa@gmail, which I haven't looked at lately, but whichever easier for you to remember. So we can all try to take this vow not to criticize anybody, and then you'll realize how, I think when you try to do that, you start to realize how critical you are. Of course, you can take the vow not to verbally be critical. And then when you do that, you'll realize mentally how difficult it is not to be critical. Okay, so yeah, if you want to write me, please do that. And we will see you next week. Same time, same station. Thank you very much. I'm glad you all attended tonight. I'm happy that you're here and enjoying these conversations and benefiting from them. Hare Krishna.